coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, 200-mile-an-hour radio engineering. What am I talking about? It's NASCAR races and how the races get covered from turn to turn to turn and how those broadcasts get back to the network. It's all coming up with Doug Watson next on Twerked. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store with outstanding service, savings, and support online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, episode 494. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. So glad to be here. I'm, as usual, since we've been definitely quarantining, I'm in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. It's also my office. And thanks a lot to Telos Alliance for supplying me with, first of all, some time every Thursday to pay attention to you and to this program, This Week in Radio Tech. And thanks to Telos for, you know, providing a few awfully cool toys like this IP intercom system and a zip stream and a zip one and just, oh, this, all this cool stuff I've got. I mean, there's more on the other side of the monitor. Got an Omnia 11 here in the studio and some Omnia MPX nodes. Yeah, they let me play. Thanks a lot, Telos, for letting me do all that here in the Telos Alliance studio. And in Nashville, Tennessee, we've had a beautiful day, a couple of rain showers, highlight of the day, but the sun has been out and it's just been gorgeous today. Took a quick walk around Radnor Lake today with my wife and kid and at lunchtime, and we saw 4 cottonmouth snakes. And that was a little bit interesting. I don't know what they were doing, but they were all wrapped around each other, just kind of in a bundle, doing some research to try to figure out what that means. Chris Tobin, you live in New York City. You got any snakes there?
Well, you have to define the phrase snake.
I knew it. The double entendre.
You knew it was coming. That was a softball. That was knocked that one out. No snakes that I know of, at least on the streets, of the reptile type, reptilians. Though if you go through Central Park, maybe you could find one or two strange-looking reptilians.
Yeah.
Two-legged type.
Yeah. You must have a beautiful weather day there. You're out on the porch again.
Yes. I am enjoying about 66 degrees, I think it was, last check. Let me see if I have that correct. I believe I do. Yeah, about 18 degrees Celsius. So, yeah. Huh. Yeah, it's nice, sunny, blue skies. It's actually one of the better days this week. But I think there's a change in the weather coming tomorrow or Saturday. So we'll see how it goes. But, you know, as a place, what does it matter?
As a certified meteorologist, I can tell you, you're always safe. You're always safe announcing, but there's a change in the weather coming. You never go wrong. You'll never go wrong with that phrase. Yeah.
I hope
you're well. Hey, you know, we've been talking a little bit about Nautel and their outreach efforts to help engineers educate themselves, learn more things, and have fun doing it. And this week is absolutely no exception. They're starting at Nautel. They're starting this really cool program called Transmission Talk Tuesday. Transmission Talk Tuesday. It's a roundtable discussion. It's not one person, you know, preaching to everybody else. It's actually roundtable every Tuesday in June. So it doesn't start this coming Tuesday, but the next Tuesday, every Tuesday in June at noon Eastern. That would be 11 a.m. for me here in the Central Time Zone. It'd be 9 a.m. out on the West Coast. Jeff Welton and special guests will introduce a topic, and then they'll open the floor for your input and questions. And I got to tell you that this is going to be a really cool series. If you want to be reminded of it or sign up for it, know that it's coming. Go to the website nautel.com/webinars. Nautel.com/webinars. Again, it's called Transmission Talk Tuesday. Chris, I don't know if you have the list in front of you. Do you have the list of their topics for June?
Hang on. I believe I do. Is that what you sent me? Yes. Yeah. June 2nd will be storm season. June 9th, transmitter travels. That's interesting. This is transmitted up and go. June 16th, yeah. HD radio as a revenue stream. It's about time we started doing something with that digital. And yeah. June 23rd, transmitter site monitoring. Now, that's key. Yeah, that's going to be a good one. Then June 30th, to wrap up the month, customer service hour. Ooh, you get to say good things about your customer service experience. Or maybe not. I had one yesterday with Alex at Nautel. It was good. We had
really?
A good time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Alex splits his time between development of cool new stuff and customer service.
Yes, we did. We did talk about the cool new stuff too. Yeah, it was good. But you know, if you haven't checked it out, you should. The webinars at Nautel, I've been watching almost every one of them. They've been very good. They're quite informative, and they're a different approach. And it's always Jeff. So Jeff knows how to sort of make you chuckle, and you have to sort of think hard and listen carefully, because when he says something, you can miss his. His innuendo is real fast, but it's good stuff. Absolutely good stuff. I recommend it for everybody. And I've enjoyed it. It's made me think about a few things, and I'm doing stuff differently. So it's worth it. Well worth it.
And this is going to be a new format. Again, not a one-to-many webinar, but an actual roundtable discussion. I was in on a roundtable discussion earlier today, and it went really well. It was Barry Mishkin's roundtable, and that was good. We'll get to talk about that on another show. But check this out, nautel.com/webinars for Transmission Talk Tuesday. Every Tuesday, there's five of them, five Tuesdays in June. Okay, welcome into the show, and I want to bring in our guest real quickly here. Chris, this is going to be a treat. I'm barely a sports fan of any kind, and I have had the pleasure of going to a couple of full-on NASCAR races. Mine, the one that I got to go to, were Talladega. I've got a standing invite to go to Bristol Motor Speedway, and this guy has the job that so many engineers want. And I doubt many could do. Let's bring in Doug Watson. Doug, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Thanks, Kurt. Thank you very much.
Good to see you, man.
It's good to be here. I think we talked about doing this for a long time and never been able to do it.
We have, and you have been so busy. You used to work for the Motor Racing Network, and that was actually why we could never talk to you on the show, is because on a Thursday afternoon, you were usually busy scrambling and that's telling true. Other engineers, people what to do. You were setting up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Setting up for the weekend every Thursday. Yep.
So I named this episode something like, you know, radio engineering or broadcast engineering at 200 miles per hour. And give us a little taste of what we're going to be hearing this hour from you. I mean, I'm interested in wireless mics and backhaul and how you coordinate all these different, give us a little tease.
We can talk about all that stuff. We've got a 53-foot hauler that we use at the track every week. It's basically a studio on wheels. We can talk fiber optics. We can talk Telos, Axia. We can talk all that stuff.
I have a feeling that we're going to. Because and you know, look, early in my career, in a different time, I've set up, you know, sports press boxes. And Chris, I'm sure you have too. You've helped stations set up the equipment in the press box. You might have two microphones or three, a field mic. You got a PA feed if you need that, crowd mics. Hey, we have sponsors here on the show that provide gear to make that all work really well. But this is different than setting up a press box because, well, I don't want to give it all away, but there are several press boxes, if you will, in the different corners of the racetrack, and mixing all those. If you ever listen to a NASCAR race on the radio and you hear bam, 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 them going around from one corner to another, it's amazing stuff. And how they coordinate all that and even do multiple feeds and the Doug is here to tell us about that. Chris, I'm looking forward to it, but right now I'm going to tell you about what's going on with these little blue lights. Are they blue on the screen? I guess they kind of are. They're kind of whitish blue. This is a Max Connect, and I've got three out of four bars here because I'm in the basement. This one is a Max Connect. This happens to be a Cradle Point box, but it works in other LTE routers as well. Max Connect is the service that will get you guaranteed connectivity. You are at a higher priority level on the LTE network than all the other users except first responders. And that means when you're doing a live remote broadcast, like from a motor a car race or from a parade or from a breaking news event where there are a lot of people show up, they're on their cell phones and you think you've got a good connection. And then all of a sudden your audio and your starts going because you don't have good data. This fixes that. Max Connect Wireless. There are so many radio groups now getting these at their transmitter sites for backup data, or even for their full-time data. This reaches out to the nearest LTE tower. You can get this on AT&T, on Verizon, or on T-Mobile, and you can even switch between them. If one of them starts out being reliable and then unreliable, or if you carry this on the road to go do live remote broadcasts and you find out, hey, where I'm sitting down here, Verizon's no good, but AT&T is. Well, by golly, just switch it over from one to the other. That's the cool thing about Max Connect Wireless. Guaranteed throughput, fixed IP address, so you always know where the thing is on the internet, and a firewall built in, and that choice of carriers. Check it out, maxconnectwireless.com. I love this stuff, and Josh Bone's been on here before. We were just talking today, Josh and I, about how many radio groups are now using MaxConnect Wireless for remotes and for transmitter site connectivity. Thanks a lot, Josh, at maxconnectwireless.com. It's spelled funny. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can click on it and go right to it. All right, Chris Tobin, we got a treat today. Doug Watson is with us. Doug, you and I met years ago because you've been a real actual broadcast engineer. I met you in Dallas, Texas at KCBI. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. We were putting in our first Scott Studio system, and you and I interfaced 12-volt control from a PR&E console to the 5-volt control in the Scott Studio system. So all the buttons worked, all the lights lit, all the things worked, and that was my first introduction to you.
That was a kind of a new thing back then. This was the mid-90s, and I don't know of other automation companies that had actually interfaced their GPIO boards to audio consoles to give you a ready light. You push the start on the console, the automation starts. And I guess we all knew this was possible, but I remember back when I worked for Scott Studios, they had a pretty substantial GPIO board, and it was tied into all the good functions in the automation system. So, hey, why not make the audio console effective and look pretty at the same time?
Yeah, we made it all work. I mean, when you touched the screen, the lights on the console came on, or you could run it from the console. Either one worked really well.
And that's right. Yeah, you start the next event on the screen with a touch screen, because that was a big deal with Scott Studios, the touch screen.
Yes.
And yes, it would make the fader that was supposed to come on, typically three faders, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And it would make the next fader actually turn on and start playing the audio. And when that event was done, the fader would turn back off. You know, correct. What made me think of, I remember Dave Scott and I working that thinking we should do this, because remember cart machines were often wired to the console that way, right?
Well, and we did them the same way. So like the next event lit the ready light on the console for the next module that was going to start. So
yeah.
we made it work very similar to a cart machine.
Well, back in the mid-90s, this was cool stuff. It's kind of de rigueur nowadays, but
it was amazing then.
Oh, wow. Well, we're here to you popped around a couple times since then, but then you started working some time ago. What has it been, 12, 13 years ago?
2006. I started in 2006 with Motor Racing Network.
Yep. Oh, okay.
So it was 13 and a half years or so.
Now, when you went to Motor Racing Network, were you a race fan at that time at all?
I was a big race fan. It was, I remember sitting, originally from Fort Worth, Texas. And, I remember sitting out at the track in Texas watching, we'd go on Friday cause it was qualifying day and practice and things like that. It wasn't as big a crowds. I'd get media credentials through the station that we'd go out there on Friday and sit and watch the cars go. And I remember sitting out there at the track thinking there's got to be a job involved in this sport for somebody with my skills. I had no idea who Motor Racing Network was or Performance Racing Network, didn't know. And I was actually on vacation and was just kind of perusing the SBE boards looking for jobs, and talked to a friend of mine who said, hey, I know the president of Motor Racing Network. You interested in working there? And I was like, well, yeah. And so I got in touch with David Hyatt, who was the president at the time. The very first phone call we had, we spent 3 hours on the phone. We talked hot rod cars. We talked airplanes. We talked, a little bit of everything. He was a man's man, liked to smoke cigars. And it was a really cool conversation. So this was like on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And by the end of the conversation, I had tickets to New Hampshire the next weekend. I flew to New Hampshire and went to the race. My interview was actually at the Cup race in New Hampshire in the MRN hauler.
And, okay. Now I'm sorry to interrupt you. You've used this term cup race quite a bit, and I'm sorry. I'm just I'm an idiot here. What is a cup race as opposed to some other kind of race?
You have the three national touring series in NASCAR are the Camping World Truck Series. So they're trucks. Okay. They look like trucks. You have the Xfinity Series, and then you have the Cup Series. The Cup Series is like they're the top ones. So Xfinity drivers, they'll start an Xfinity Series, race for a year or two, if they're really good, they'll move up to the Cup Series. It's almost, it's kind of like the minor leagues, but not really.
So both the Xfinity and the Cup Series, those are both driving the S and the C stock car in the NASCAR name, right? I mean, that's what looks like it. That's what looks like a car. In the 2009 Chevy Malibu, it's, you know, okay.
Yeah. Right?
Okay.
Yes.
So as a broadcast engineer, but not a real big sports guy, but as a broadcast engineer, tell me a little bit about how a NASCAR race is covered. What's the mechanics of the announcers? You know, why isn't it just one guy way up in the top stands looking at the cars going around? Why is it not that?
It's on TV, the cameras are the eyeballs. And if you notice on TV, the announcers talk about the race, talk about what you're seeing. For radio, our announcers are describing what they're seeing for you. So you can hear what's going on at the race. You can listen to the race and picture in your head what is going on. And so that's the difference. So we have, depending on the size of the track, you'll have 2, 3, 1 turn announcer in the turns of the track. We have a couple of guys upstairs in a broadcast booth, and they're kind of the air traffic control. They call for all the commercials. They do the laps and rundown. They do the cautions. They do those kind of things. They kind of keep the race going. There's a producer up there with them that kind of keeps track of what's going on so that we play all the commercials and things like that. And so that's kind of the logistics of the race. We've got a truck in the infield, a hauler that looks off from the outside, looks just like one of the NASCAR team haulers. But our truck had slide outs. There were 2 studios in it, 2, 3 little control rooms. And it was basically a rolling studio in the infield of the track. We had a 40-channel console in there. All the sources come to this console. All those sources are then mixed along with the commercials. We had a wide orbit audio, what is now was Scott Studios, in the truck. So all the commercials, everything that left the track was a broadcast program. All the closures, all the cues, everything that left the track was that way. Originally, we had a C-band uplink truck that MRN owned and operated that we took with us. And we would uplink back to the latest is Westwood One. And Westwood One would distribute the programming out to the radio stations.
So, okay, wow, we got a lot of good stuff to cover here. And you've got some pictures to show, too. We'll get to those in a few minutes. Describe for me again, you said the turn announcers. And I've seen some NASCAR tracks that are ovals or they're squared ovals. Mm-hmm. I've been to Talladega, which kind of has an extra little leg in the backside, doesn't it?
Right. They call it the super stretch.
And then there's Bristol, which is described as a toilet bowl. That's almost a turn the whole time, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's Bristol's just a half mile track, so it's a quarter mile with a turn at each end. It's a drag race. Ah. 2 drag races per lap with a left turn at each end. Same thing for Martinsville. Okay. Talladega and Daytona are both 2.5 mile tracks. So we'll have 3 turn announcers there. You have somebody. So the broadcast goes, they cross the start finish line. The people in the booth call the race. What's going on with the race? They call it till they can't see it, or not really till they can't see it, but till it's just out of sight. So then the guy is typically in turn 2 in a tower with binoculars. And he has a push to talk on a headset, and he picks up the push to talk, picks up the action, and calls it all the way through turn 1, all the way through turn 2, and almost at his feet drops it. That's where he should be dropping it, is when they're at his feet. Mm. The next guy on a Talladega is at the end of the backstretch, does the same thing. Binoculars, push to talk, picks up the action, calls it into turn 3. There's a guy typically in turn 4 that then, same thing, binoculars, push to talk, calls through turn 4 and back onto the front stretch where the booth picks it up and calls it down the front stretch. And it just goes round and round like that, play by play.
Now, wow. Okay. So what happens if something goes out of order? Like there's a crash that's not in front of the guy that's talking.
Everybody's mic is hot all the time. The turns have a push to talk. The pit guys have a handheld mic, but it's got an on off. It's a Sennheiser mic with an on off on it. All right. So if there's a crash, the turn guys break in, trouble in turn 2, you know, 3 cars around, looks like this. It then goes back to the booth where they call the caution. They throw it back out to the turn. The turn guy then describes what happened. And then they go on from there. Then it's a caution. There's, you're going to have pit stops. So you're going to have, if there's a problem with a car, you're going to have a pit guy that's going to go over to the team and ask what's going on. There are three or four pit guys at the track, depending on how many, what series you're running, things like that. So,
We're going to look at these pictures in a few minutes, I promise. But I'm curious about, because yesterday you were telling me about the headset gear and different iterations. Yes. Of different equipment you went through. Whatever you want to do, if you want to tell us about how it used to be and how it is now, I'd be very curious to understand what these turn announcers are wearing and how their signal gets back to sure. the truck.
Originally, when I started, we had a big belt and an Anton Bauer battery pack and a big electrosonic transmitter and a cable that went up to a headset. And the headsets were all made by Racing Electronics. We would buy biodynamic microphones and put on them. Racing Electronics would put the biodynamic microphone on them. We would wire in a Shure push-to-talk switch and wire it into the transmitter, and that's how they talked. Probably 6-7 years ago, when Electrosonics came out with the SMQV transmitter, we took one. We figured out what they weighed. I was reading on their website and figured out what they weighed. We took a project box and loaded it with little nuts and bolts until we got to that weight. We taped it to one of our headsets and took it to one of our turn announcers and said, could you live with this? And he said, sure. So we eliminated the whole belt pack. Racing Electronics made the headsets for us. We clipped the SMQV transmitter just on the headset with the biodynamic microphone and the push-to-talk in line. And they have a two-way radio that they listen to. There's a Marty transmitter in the truck, and that transmits the programming. And they have a two-way radio that they listen to themselves on. And that's basically the turn guy. He's got a headset, an SMQV transmitter, and a Motorola radio.
That SMQV transmitter, is that analog technology?
It is. I believe it is. Yeah, we've tried some digitals one time, and they just didn't. They didn't have the range. When we were in Daytona, the truck was almost a mile from turn two, and so, and we have on the truck has a Wilbert pneumatic mast, and we would put Yagis up on the mast, pointing in the turn directions, and that's how we would receive those turns. But we stretched them far beyond their limits of what they were should be doing. So we would scan. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you just answered one of my questions, which, yeah, what are you using for antennas on the truck? Let's look at what are you using for antennas in for the turn announcers. Are they wearing an antenna on their head?
Just a little whip right on the SMQV transmitter. Be sitting right on their head with just a little whip on it.
The whip that comes with the transmitter.
The whip that comes with the transmitter.
What frequency band or range were these typically in?
We had, since there was so much stuff at the track, we would scan every week, and typically you had to scan every day and find places to put the transmitters. Some tracks were worse than others. California was terrible. Everything was blocked out in California. You had only a couple of spaces you could put stuff. Chicago was big cities typically. Dallas, Fort Worth was terrible. Chicago was terrible. But we would scan, pick frequencies, and then set up our transmitters. And we carried with us at least three transmitters each in blocks 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26. So
what
we had
does that
a
mean
wide
in terms
range
of frequency?
They were in the, I'm trying to think what a 22 is. They're around six. They're 500 and 600 megahertz is that range. Gotcha.
Yeah. They're in the now, the new UHF TV channels is where they're located.
Yes.
Okay.
But, when I left, we were working on getting all of the, 24s, 25s and 26s reblocked because they were in 600 megahertz range that got taken away.
Yeah. Okay, so the corner announcers, they're up high. They have line of sight with your truck, or at least with the Wilbert mast on the truck, and they're just got that little whip. And what's the longest, over a mile at one of the tracks?
It was about a mile at Daytona, yeah. It was about a mile.
Wow, 5,280 feet from the little bitty transmitter on the and were the batteries contained in that transmitter?
Yeah, the batteries, SMQV uses two AA batteries. And so we figured out that the if you buy Ultimate Lithium batteries, they would last about 7.5 hours. And so we would buy, I budgeted $1,500 for batteries twice a year. We would buy them in bulk, get a big, huge box of AA Ultimate Lithium batteries twice a year. And we carried them on the truck and just replaced them every broadcast.
Wow. Now, I'm a little curious. You mentioned the Marty back feed to the announcers. What radio exactly were you using to pick that up so they could listen in their earbud?
It was a Motorola radio that was provided by Racing Electronics for us.
Oh, okay.
Just a standard Motorola. I think they were CP202s, or I can't remember what the model number was. They're just a plain Motorola radio.
And so you just used a Marty transmitter. What was it, VHF or UHF?
It was an SRPT40, and it was on 454, which it was unlicensed. It's an offshore emergency frequency. And that's kind of the known frequency at the track for radio. And it took me the longest time to get over the fact that it wasn't licensed. The only saving grace was by the time we turned it on Friday, if anybody complained, we were gone by Monday. So,
Okay.
And there was only a couple of times we ever had any issues. Miami, when we were in Miami, we heard some people on it one time that were saying, "Hey, MRN's on our frequency." Other than that, really had no issues with it ever. So
since you were all analog, and since all these corner announcers could hear each other as well as the what you call them, the booth announcers, mm-hmm. the guy, okay,
mm-hmm. yeah,
they all hear each other in real time. This is all analog technology, and so there's no delay really between everybody. It's just like everybody's
correct.
It's like everybody's in a studio, except they're spread out over a mile or so.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow. And same thing for the booth announcers. Are they wireless also to the truck?
The booth is not wireless. When I started, we used dry pair to the booth. So we had 11 dry pair, which was a battle every single week. We eventually moved that to fiber, and we started slowly but surely getting fiber installed at every track. And initially, we used a telecast adder. And we would have, we had 16 channels bidirectional. So that helped us a whole lot. We eventually moved when we built the current truck, we had put Axia in it. And so we connected Cisco switch in the booth to Cisco switch in the truck via fiber optic cable just extended the Axia network up there. And so the whole booth became Axia. It was so simple then because we didn't have to worry about line level and mic level and, you know, how are you going to get this here and get that there? We just threw a mic node in there and a couple of line nodes in there and GPIO because the producer in the booth fires the commercials in the truck for network commercials. So it all just worked flawlessly once we put that in there.
That kind of blows my mind when you mention this. So that's cool about using the Axia AOIP network between the truck and the booth. But the producer is up in the booth with those announcers, and that producer is the person who is pushing the button to let all the affiliates start their spot break, right?
Well, for the network breaks, the breaks that MRN played, he fired those because there was no audio cue for those. So they would just be talking along and he would hit the commercial. He would hit the commercial when it was time to play the commercial. For the local breaks, there is an audio cue. And so when they would do the audio cue, the guy in the truck would fire the commercial sitting at the console in the truck. And with that commercial, we would send a closure that would let the local stations fire their local breaks.
So, we'll tell you what, after our own commercial break here, we're going to get into how the whole backhaul world works. And we're going to look at these pictures. By the way, those pictures, are they from the truck or what are they from?
They are from the newest truck that's now currently probably 7 years old.
All righty. Hey, this week in Radio Tech, we're talking to Doug Watson and formerly with Motor Racing Network, MRN, and Director of Engineering there. A lot of cool stuff. And I always wondered how some of this stuff worked. Because, you know, I've done remote. Chris Tobin, you've done remote broadcasts. In fact, in New York City, you've done some pretty fantastical ones with the help of TV stations to get them done. But I've always wondered how, you know, week after week after week, how Motor Racing Network gets these people in the corners and how they get that done. That kind of amazing.
There's a lot of coordination. A lot of coordination when I worked at ABC and at Westwood One. There was a lot of coordination for those programs and network shows. So
yeah,
it's timing.
Wow. yeah. Well, I'm eager to see the truck coming up and hear about backhaul and network distribution. So that's coming up. Again, we're talking to Doug Watson, formerly director of engineering over at Motor Racing Network. And we'll also talk at the end of the show about what Doug is doing nowadays. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store. You didn't believe this. I was just talking to Dave Kirsten on the phone a little while ago, just before the show started. He's actually up here in Tennessee. He's putting some, my employer is putting some Axia gear into a station in Northwest Tennessee. So glad to see that. But BGS takes care of distributing, selling a lot of different pieces of equipment that broadcast engineers need. And one of those is from Henry Engineering. This is a new product from Henry Engineering. It's the Henry Superlight. Now, if you've been in broadcast any time at all as an engineer, you know about the Henry Super Relay. We've used those in radio stations, TV stations all around the place. And the Henry Super Relay, you give it a little contact closure and it'll light up for you on the studio on air light or the recording light. It would even make it flash if you wanted to. Plus, it would give you lots of auxiliary closures if you needed to do other things like start a recorder or lock the door or whatever, you know, not that I recommend that. But anyway, now so many broadcast facilities are using LED lights, whether in the on-air light over the door or in those rings that come in the mic arms. Those are LED. Any kind of LED thing you want to do, the super light will run for you. It comes with a little wall wart power supply, 12 volts DC. It has relay outputs. There's the webpage. That's a good place to look. Like I said, relay outputs, control inputs, and it's got this control link IO where you can take an ordinary Cat5 cable and RJ45 connectors, and you can daisy chain from one of these to another to another. And you know what? You just open the box up, and inside each of these super lights, they have some little header connectors. You just jumper for the wires that you want to pick off. So if you want to the possibilities are just kind of endless here as to what you can do, but you can have these boxes all behave differently, even though they're all connected with the same Cat5 cables, because you just pick off the leads that you want to use internally. A good way to look at this, just go to the website at henryeng.com, henryeng.com, and look for the Superlight LED Tally Light Controller. And you know where you get these, you know. Don't order them from Hank. He'll charge you full price. You need to call Broadcasters General Store, where you can get a discount on the Henry Super Light. Love this little box. So cool, lightweight, easy to mount, just like that. Got some screw holes there. And it's even got little places, little dimples here to put feet in case you want it to kind of rest silently on the wall underneath the audio console, whatever you want. And every one of these Henry gear comes with schematic diagrams. Look at that. In these days where manuals can be hard to find, hard to follow, Henry gives you the schematic diagram. So in case you got to fix it in 20 years from now, you got it right there. Thanks a lot, Henry. And thanks a lot, Broadcaster General Store, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. To get to BGS, give them a call at 352-622-7700, or you can go to their website at bgs.cc, bgs.cc, Broadcasters General Store. Thanks again. All righty. We're talking, Chris and I are talking with Doug Watson, formerly the head of engineering over at Motor Racing Network, MRN. And some of my radio stations have carried NASCAR races for years. They're a big hit with the listeners. We have a very loyal audience. Doug, I wonder if you can kind of fill us in on what the audience was like and what's the distribution like on these kind of radio races on the radio.
Sure. You want to air chain? Or you want to?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, people. How big is the audience for motor race? Because not everybody watching this show is a race fan, and I kind of barely am.
Right.
I've got a good friend who's a huge race fan. My friend Roger. I think I may have introduced him to you. And Roger took me to a couple of Talladega races, and I had a blast. But prior to that, I wasn't a race fan, and now I've got a couple of drivers that I follow, and I'm kind of interested in what they're doing. But I don't know if I'm typical or not, but there are some people who are just enormous race fans. They won't miss it for anything, and they can't go to every race. Certainly, it's just financially too expensive. So they listen on the radio if they're at their job, they're working, they're driving around. So what's that audience like in terms of size?
Yeah, it's absolutely nuts how many people can listen. We hit between 400 and 500 stations for a cup race each week. I don't know the actual audience numbers on that. I just know the approximate station count. So
I would have to guess you guys that a typical race it's got to be close to 1 million people listening. I mean, I may be off by a factor of two, but I think 1 million's pretty safe to say. Yeah, maybe it's a lot higher than that. Yeah. So you're distributing I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, between 400 and 500 stations, it's you can hear it almost everywhere.
Why don't we, is this a good time to look at some pictures of the truck? Because before we get into the backhaul and the distribution, let's see what's inside the truck.
Sure.
Suncast, if you want to just bring those up in the order that they are, that would be great. And we'll describe what's going on. What's this?
That's the main studio, looking into the main control room. That's right up in the front of the truck.
This is in the 53-foot truck.
This is in the 53-foot truck. So basically, okay, we became the studio at the track. We can do shows from there what would happen a lot of times is teams would call us and say, hey, our driver needs to record a spot for sponsor. Can we come to your truck? Absolutely. We would bring them over. They would sit down. We would record it on a thumb drive, hand them the thumb drive, and off they would go.
Or how about that?
Sometimes we had agencies that would want to listen in. So we would connect up with the agency. They would listen in. Driver would come over, record the spot. They would coach, want a little this, a little that. Driver would record the spot again, off they would go. In fact, the NASCAR Heat, that's the video game. One of the NASCAR video games, the drivers came over and a lot of them recorded the audio that went into the video game in our truck sitting right there in that studio.
That's a good way to get them. They're right there on site.
They'd have a stack of scripts, there's things they needed to read, and they would come over and just read them. Just read and record and read and record. They were for the video game for EA Sports.
I see you're using the Mika mic arms.
I love those things. They are fantastic. These aren't the ones with the lights on them, but they are just the plain mic arms. I just like the way they look. This thing it's a showpiece. It was nice to be able to drag people through and take a look. I can't tell you how many we'd have broadcast engineers come by and they would come through and say, this place is nicer than our studios. It was a really nice piece of hardware. It took probably a year of design and build work, and it was about $1.5 million.
Now, it's a little bit different than a traditional radio station in that, well, you've got mics and headphones, certainly, and places for people to sit and talk, and lots of sound deadening on the walls. Let's look at the next picture, Suncast, and see what we see. Now, that audio console, that's not quite what I expected. What is that?
You're correct. That is an Allen and Heath console. The thing about the broadcast is all 10 auxiliary sends are used for different things. So it's a whole lot easier for the board operator just to go directly to the aux send and twist it rather than go menu, knob, you know. So we put an analog console in. The entire backbone of the truck is Axia. So we have at the time when we designed it, International Speedway Corporation's IT department came down and sat down with us, and we told them what we needed. The truck has probably $60,000 to $70,000 worth of IT gear on it: Cisco switches, routers, voice over IP stuff, wireless network. So when we would get to the track, any track that was an ISC track, we would plug the network in, and we could plug in via fiber, or we could plug in via copper, or we could actually connect up wirelessly. Once connected to the truck just became part of the ISC network. It was just like sitting in the office. You had all your VPNs, you had all your VLANs. Every VLAN that was in the office is available in the truck. So you didn't have to, if you brought your laptop out of the truck, it was just like you were in the office. When it connected to wireless, you had all the internal company, everything was there. Your internal, you know, your network drives, everything was there. So we set it up like that. We also built the Axia network in it on its own VLAN and crossed a couple of places so that we could get in and do things. But all X nodes, and that was one of my big concerns. And I talked to Axia a couple of times about it. These things are going to be going down the road. Are they rugged? You know, they move down the road every week. How are they going to last? Are they going to last? Are they going to be okay? We never had an issue with one. Never had an issue with an X node.
Wow.
And that version of the truck, that's when we first built it. We still had an uplink truck, a C-band uplink truck. This truck would connect to that truck via fiber optic cable. We had Axia nodes over there as well, and we would send the audio over there. The ISDN units, you see the Telos Zephyr ISDN units.
Yeah, I see the Zephyrs. Yeah,
those were backups to Westwood One, and the C-band uplink was the primary. That has all since changed. We went to corporate and asked them for money to build a new uplink truck, and they said, you're probably going to need to find a different way to do that. So, again, I went to Telos folks and said, hey, this is what I need to do. They said, have you looked at our Zip 1s? So we put Zip 1s in there. As the ISDN slowly went away, we ended up taking them completely out of the truck. And I'll tell you that we installed an ISDN, two of them, at every track that we went to, you know, for a month. So it would show up, be there for when we used it, and take it out. Now, if it was a track we went to twice a year, and it was more economical to leave it in, install it the first time, leave it into the second time, and take it out, we would do that. But just in ISDN lines, when we stopped using them, we saved $40,000 a year.
What?
Just on ISDN costs. Yes.
Oh, gee. So
we took those out, and we put Zip 1s in. We put, there are four in the truck. There are two that sit on the ISC network and two that sit on the public internet. So we put an MPLS circuit, an instance of the ISC network at Westwood One, and we put two there on that and two sitting on the public internet. So we would have, we would hook up two, one on the MPLS circuit and one on the public internet for every race. And that's how, that was our primary and our backup. And then if those two went down, NASCAR would backhaul it to Charlotte, where we could log into our Telos Zephyr units in the shop from the truck, connect one to downtown, and connect one to Westwood One, and turn it around in the shop via ISDN if we absolutely had to.
Wow. Yeah, three different ways to get it there. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's continue our pictorial tour here. What's the next picture there, Suncast?
So that's still the
one. Oh, by the way, yes, I see some wide orbit there. Is that wide orbit automation?
That is wide orbit. Wide orbit automation there in the truck. This, this would be an edit suite. There are two of these actually in the truck. If you can see, we put the little rack console in there because that's really what they needed.
It's way up high. Radios, it's right? Up high.
Yeah, it's way up high. The stack of radios you see in front of you are racing electronics radios. That's how we would, if you ever hear a driver on the radio that has been recording, you know, Kyle Busch had a wreck. This is what he said just before the wreck. Play it back. Mm-hmm. So those computers there had Adobe Audition on them, and he would record all those driver channels constantly. If something would happen, he would go back and grab one, edit it, and have it ready to go on another computer that they could fire from the booth to play those spots in the broadcast.
Now, there are six radios there. It looks like six radios. Did you have to pick six drivers?
He would pick six drivers. Now, we would update those each week with frequencies, so he could pick any six drivers he wanted. They were frequency agile, so he would just run them up and down to whoever he's wanting to listen to. Typically, he would hit whoever's running in the front.
So, yeah. Wow. So
and
you've
again,
got recording.
When the truck was first built, there was an ISDN unit in that studio, too. You could actually do two different shows out of the truck and sometimes three out of the truck at the same time, depending on what we had going on. So
I'm sorry. My curiosity is still a little bit piqued here on the driver audio. Sure. Is the driver transmitting all the time, or are you just getting him when he pushed the talk?
Just when he pushed the talk. So they have a spotter.
Okay.
Since I don't know if you've ever seen a driver in the race car, they can't turn their heads and look. You're strapped into the car. So there's a guy upstairs on the top of the tower with a radio talking to the driver, telling him, you know, there's a car outside, there's a car inside. You can't move here. You can't, you know, that kind of thing. So the driver talks, the spotter talks, the crew chief talks. They can all talk during the race to each other. And so that's what we would be listening to is that.
Let's see the next picture then.
This is a small talk studio that is in between the two edit suites. So the edit suite you just saw is just to the right of this picture through that glass. There's another one just to the left through glass. Sometimes we would need to have a show going on up front in the bigger studio, and a driver or somebody would need to come in and record something. So we would put them in this studio, and they would use one of the little edit suites to record as well.
Cool. What's next? Almost. Come on, picture. You can do it. There we go.
that's the edit suite that was to the left. It's very similar to the other one, just worked a little different. You can see the rack console up there high, little small compact Cisco switch up there high. They have a computer. These computers also had they had a computer for Adobe Audition and editing and things like that, but they also had a wide orbit computer in each one of them. They could back up the main control room if they needed to.
Now, with both of these rack consoles, these are little rack mount mixers from Axia. They're located kind of up out of reach. I take it they didn't have to ride the pots a whole lot. It was pretty much set and forget.
Correct. Yeah, it was a set and forget kind of thing. They didn't get used a whole lot. I mean, they a little bit of here, a little bit there, but not too terribly much. The other edit suite gets used during the race for the driver audio. But again, yeah, that was kind of a set and forget deal.
Do we have one more picture to look at, I think?
I think we do. I think it's the main. This is the main lobby of the truck. So
this is the truck?
What you have is this is inside the truck. You have you have a place for the talent to work. So typically at a race, you've got two booth guys. You've got three or four pit people. You've got two, maybe three turn people. At Road America, we had nine turn people. And if you see the door up there towards the back, that door goes up to the front of the truck, the control room, and that front studio up in the truck. The edit suites are on the left side of this room that you see here. It's a slide out. The whole thing slid out. When it closed up, those tables folded down that are on the left there, and those chairs went into an edit suite, and it closed all the way up to those chairs that are on the right side.
Yeah.
Those chairs on the right side are captured on a little arm. So they sit there and they move out, and that's about it.
Yeah. Wow. Did you know much about truck technology before you took this job?
I didn't. I had at KCBI, we had done some Promise Keepers events. Mm-hmm. And out behind Texas Stadium doing the Promise Keepers event was the ESPN truck doing the TV for it. And got to talk. We had a little small trailer with a KU band uplink, and that's how we got the audio back to the station. But I got to talking with the engineer of the truck. And he showed me all through his truck, and I was just amazed that this was his truck and that he knew everything about it. And, you know, it was such an amazing thing to me that this was his truck, and so much stuff was going on in it. And I knew nothing. I got there. We actually had two trucks. There's an older truck. Her name is Christine, and the newer truck's name was Damien. And yes, we had a weird sense of humor with naming our trucks. Christine was the first truck, and she wasn't nearly as technologically, she was all analog. Everything was point to point wiring, a lot of studio hub stuff. And so when we built this truck, we wanted to kind of move it into the Axia world. And we wanted to, we designed some things out of the old truck that some issues that were with the old truck that we didn't design into the new truck, and fixed it. And it's oddly enough, after we'd had it a year, there were still changes I would make with a new truck. So,
yeah. So you described going from an all analog world and some ISDN and then into the IP world. And that's where the technology kind of sits now. You're all, well, of course, you still have analog. The wireless is still analog.
Correct.
Coming from
correct.
The corners. Because that's what seems to work in the, and very low delay, if any delay. So that's important.
Correct.
It's almost like everybody's wired, whereas we know that digital systems often have a little bit of latency in them, and if it adds up, it can end up being too much. Do you see any changes in the future in how races like NASCAR races get covered?
Well, I think that some of the things that, I mean, you know, technology is constantly changing. With the 600 megahertz stuff going away, that put a real crimp in things. What we were working on when I left was running fiber to each turn, so that the folks in the turns would be on fiber back to the truck as well. So you've got to have a way to convert that audio to light in a turn and then convert it back to audio in the truck. But we had found a way to do that with some boxes made by a company called Sescom. So we were working on that. We were still going to leave the pit guys wireless, but that reduced our wireless need from, you know, 7 to 4 or 7 to 3 or, you know, 9 to 3 or... It reduced it down quite a bit. So I think that was going to work really well for what was going on. I'll tell you, a lot of TV stuff is they're doing remote back to Charlotte. So a lot of the TV announcers, especially in the truck series, are sitting in Charlotte. So it looks like they're at the track, but they're sitting in Charlotte doing the announcing. You have a pit guy. They don't necessarily have turn people because they have cameras out there that can see what's going on. So that's kind of how that works. And I don't know that radio will ever get there, but it might.
I saw that for the first time. I was in Australia, and they showed me how it's economically not always worthwhile to send, you know, 3-4 announcers out to a footy game or whatever they're playing out there, and they have a private video feed from the television partner, and the private television feed gives them more than what the audience at home might see, and so they have a table there and a row of microphones and headphones, and they call the game from Sydney, Australia. The game might be somewhere else.
It's crazy. Wow. It's crazy. I've seen their setup downtown. They have all the video feeds. So they have, you know, NASCAR Productions in downtown Charlotte. They have all the monitor feeds so they can see what's going on, and they just stand there and call the race.
Chris Tobin has a lot of experience with doing, outside broadcasts, live remotes all over the New York City metro area. I know he's been involved with a lot of them and still is. He and Sam Wu do some projects together. Chris, you've been quiet again. What might you have to ask or add to our conversation with Doug?
No, Doug hit it on the head. I mean, it's the remote outside broadcast venues and what's going on nowadays. The technology is unbelievable. I was doing stuff with Inmarsat, 15, 20 years ago, that was considered state of the art at the time. And then we moved to fiber. We had fiber cables from the truck that, you know, we used to, when I worked at ABC, I did a lot with the TV side of the family, and we did a lot of radio and TV together, and fiber was the big thing. And then slowly, years later, IP became the big thing. And now it's just your imagination is what really controls it. I mean, you can, as he pointed out, put fiber at a turn, and now you can get what you need, I will say, though, the wireless crimping, that has definitely caused some issues for folks here in New York City, especially because some places just do not work well with trying to do wired, or I'll call, glass installations, whereas wireless would be a much better approach, but so be it.
All right.
Yeah,
wow.
You boil it down to it. We just did a big remote every week. That's all we did.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
That's
exactly it.
That's a good way of thinking about it. But I tell you, not that any remote is not important, but man, every one of these had to go off. Okay. Doug, can you recall maybe a close call when you weren't sure if you're going to get on the air or not, and you found your way to fix it and make it go?
Do we really want to talk about those?
It's up to you. It's up to you.
I'll tell you, the last year, so not this last Daytona 500, but the year before, mm-hmm. our first broadcast of the year, we were in the truck race, which was on Friday night. We had 10 laps to go, and there was a wreck and a caution. And we went to a commercial break, local commercial break. We lost... I don't remember what we lost. One of the zips, like the network in the truck dropped. Now we put two networks. So we would have a network feed from International Speedway Corporation, and NASCAR would provide us a network feed too, different networks. So the ones that were on the public internet were on NASCAR's network. The ones that were on our network were the ones that were connected directly to Westwood One. The commercial break is a minute long, minute 10 seconds. We realized that the feed had dropped to Westwood One. I made a phone call to Westwood One, got their operator on the phone, told him what was going on. They switched to the backup zip, audio and closures, control closures, with about 6 seconds left in our commercial break. We came back and nobody had any clue that we missed anything. It was just one of those, and I'm like, we've got 6 laps left in a close race. This is going to be terrible. If we lose the last 6 laps, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
So fortunately we were able to, our redundancies worked, and it worked like it was supposed to. And the guy at Westwood One was on the ball, and just boom, we got it swapped over and right back on the air. And nobody has any idea that it even happened.
And thank goodness the Westwood One operator in charge of their knock was, answered the phone quickly. That's what the person's there to do, but thank goodness.
We've had a lot of stuff like that. Early on, we were in New Hampshire. Power goes out in the tower So now all of a sudden our broadcast booth is on a UPS that's in the booth and it's beeping and we have no idea how long that's going to last. So I grab a bunch of wireless headsets and run around there and get, you know, to the elevator, which doesn't work without power. So I climb the stairs up to the top of the tower, get to the booth, walk into the booth, and I'm about dying, you know, panting, dying, just bent over. And one of the TV guys comes over and throws an extension cord in and goes, "Hey, here's a cord connected to our generator if you need it." So we plugged the UPS into their cord and we were fine at that point. So, but it's just, you know, there's always something, always something.
Wow. Wow. What a story. That and it's neat to think, you know, they're doing a live remote broadcast. And as Suncast, our producer, points out, a remote that sometimes covers a 2.5 mile area. And do one of these every week and make sure that it gets to 500 radio stations.
Yeah, well, and, you know, 2.5 miles was the big tracks, but we did a track in Road America that was a 4.5 mile road course. We'd had 9 turns, and we took 2 trucks up there to catch them all. We would take a small truck with a mast and catch 6 turns on the mast and send it via fiber back to the main truck, bring it out of an adder into an Axia node, and then put them all on the board. We had 9 turns on that race. It was crazy. And it gave me goosebumps every time. We would set it up and test it. But when the race started, they crossed the start-finish line. And you heard every announcer call their turn. And the cars go by every single, for 9 turns. Took them 2.5 minutes to get around the track. It was it just gave me goosebumps every time. It was just amazing working with these people. Just cool stuff.
Your description of having the backup system for the Westwood One feed, Chris Tobin, this is always Chris's mantra. Of course, Chris works in a number one market, and it shouldn't matter if you're in market one or market 151. It's good to have backups.
Always,
Chris. Chris. Can I get a comment from you before we go to our last break about that?
Well, planning for mission critical. Well, yeah, I would say in the early days when I worked at radio stations, we did a lot of broadcasts, revenue generating broadcasts, and the programming folks always wanted to make sure we had a backup. It was always, if we're going to do it, we have to have a backup. Then when I went to work for the networks, that was just a given. If you didn't have a backup, you'd be looking for a job in a fruit stand. But yeah, backups are key. And the trick is understanding what you're backing up and how much of a backup you have. You know, UPS can only handle so much, and generators the same way. So you got to be careful. You don't put everything on there. Like, the coffee maker stays off, and the microwave can't be on backup.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been there. I have been in places where they've done that, and they can't figure out why we keep it dark and the generator.
Now, we're talking to Doug Watson, former director of engineering at the Motor Racing Network, and learning a lot of things about how to cover an event as big, because it can be huge, as a NASCAR race, and how they do, and the precision by which they, if you ever listen to one of these, you need to listen to one when they get going again. It's pretty amazing stuff. Hey, this week in Radio Tech, we got our tip of the week coming up, and Doug tells me he's got a doozy. So we're going to wait for Doug. Doug, I'm going to do a quick break here, and then we're going to come back to Doug for a tip of the week, and maybe Chris will have one too. My tip is that you check this out. You know, we're broadcasting from home. A lot of us are. And maybe you need a telephone hybrid at home. And, you know, you don't have POTS service anymore. How do you make this work? Well, use your cell phone and take that Bluetooth and connect up to a real professional Bluetooth interface device. And that would be this right here. The Bluetooth audio gadget from our friends at Angry Audio. Yeah, this thing just works so cool. It's got a little switch on the front here to pair it with your phone, or to reset it. You can also connect Bluetooth, of course. That's what it's meant to do. But it also has a wired connection on the front if you want to use one of those tip ring sleeve cables to connect your phone, if it still has that, into the Bluetooth gadget. You can connect it that way. And then on the back, you can see on the picture here, it's got professional XLR connections. So you've got an audio in that's analog in. You've got stereo audio coming out of it, because you can play stereo audio from your phone or tablet or other Bluetooth device right out of this. And you can also have a digital, an AES output, if that's what you need to come in with. This thing, it's got a built-in power supply. You plug it in the wall. It sits there. It runs beautifully. And you know what? You better call for the price. Call your favorite dealer. But this thing costs a lot less than I thought it would. This is a great way. If you're at home, you want to get callers onto your podcast or onto your broadcast, this is a great way to do it. The Bluetooth Audio Gadget, we call it the Bluetooth Audio Gadget from Angry Audio. The website is angryaudio.com. And don't get away without me reminding you that Angry Audio now has the whole range of these Studio Hub adapters, the cable adapters. This is one of the original ones. This is my favorite. This is the kind that has the female XLR connector. And you put whatever length of RJ45 to go back to your node, whatever you need to go into, that's also a Studio Hub wired device. This one has the female connectors on it. You can also get it with male. You can get a quarter-inch tip ring sleeve. You can get bare wires. You can get RCA connectors, all the different kinds of things, but they all wire back to that Studio Hub standard. And don't forget, when you order one of these with the female RJ45 on it, ask your dealer to give you a free cable. There's a free 7-foot Cat 5 cable with your name on it, but you have to ask for it. That's getting your name associated with the one that's waiting for you. For every one of these you buy, you get a free 7-foot shielded cable. It's got the pinouts right there. So check that out. AngryAudio.com is the website, and your favorite dealers should carry Angry Audio. And don't let anybody talk into something else. Studio Hub, the genuine stuff, is now made and available and in stock. And Angry Audio has it. So check that out. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right. It's episode 494. We've been talking to Doug Watson, formerly with the Motor Racing Network. Doug, I think you have a tip for us, and you said it'd be good.
So, I'll tell you what, you can never have enough of those dongles. Those things are lifesavers. Oh, my gosh.
Aren't they? Yes, I know. Oh.
Okay, so quick tip. You're messing with fiber optic cable. All of our cable was ST to ST. Everything that we dealt with. We had a lot of jumpers that we used, some of them that weren't any good. If you weren't any good, we try to clip the ends off of them so we wouldn't use them again. But you're messing with them in a booth. You're trying to hook things up. You don't have your fiber light to check it out. This thing here, you put your fiber optic cable right there on your flashlight on your phone, you can get a little pin of light out of the other end and tell if your fiber is good or not.
And are you looking into the fiber, or are you projecting it onto a piece of paper or something?
Oh, no, it's not bright enough to project onto a piece of paper. If you look into it, you can see the little dot of light in the middle of the fiber. Yeah, I know you're not supposed to look in them, but, you know, in a pinch. Sometimes
what's a typical failure mode for an ST fiber patch?
They're open.
They break?
I mean, the actual connector, you know, the little strain relief on the connector end, the light escapes. It's just, they just go bad.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Your cell phone. So I have a fiber cable tester right here, don't I? In my hand.
Right there. Yeah. It takes two people, because you got to hold it in there and you got to have somebody look at the other end. So
yeah. Yeah.
It's hard. Okay. You need one extra hand to do it all, but it's, it works. It's worked for us. So if you don't have a fiber light handy, a little laser handy, then you can use your flashlight.
Now, I've done a little bit of fiber in my radio stations, not much. What is a fiber light?
A fiber light is just, it's a laser. And usually it's got you slip the ST connector in it, turn it on, and it's bright on the other end. It'll come out bright. You can actually shine it on a wall or whatever. And that's, you know, if you're, somebody's upstairs in the booth and you're down in the truck trying to figure out which fiber is which, one end shines a fiber light and you've got, boom, you see fiber, obviously.
Gotcha.
Now this trick, I never tried it long distance like that. I've only tried it on, you know, 10, 15 foot jumpers. But you know, you're up in the booth messing with stuff and you got a fiber, you don't know if it works or not. There's your light.
Cool. What a great idea. And the fiber light too. I'm going to look that up. Chris Tobin, do you have a tip for us this week?
Absolutely. Since we've been talking outside broadcast and networking and audio over IP and stuff, something to think and consider about, since we're all, operating pretty much, I'll say, off-site remotely for many of our business operations. Revisit when you're doing your network operation stuff internally, VLANs. Very important. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about some work and VLANing his setup, so that, you know, your mission-critical stuff like broadcast revenue, automation systems, and audio over IP equipment is on as a VLAN separate from, say, the business administration. Since they're all off-site, you can't really control how they're connecting to your office network and what they're doing. So you might want to make sure you have a little added security, if you will, to protect everybody. It also helps you with load balancing and bandwidth and stuff. But just food for thought. Revisit VLANs in your network, in your operation, and segment people. So this way you can protect the mission-critical stuff, since the building may be empty and you don't have access to everything locally when you need it.
And just to make it clear, VLANs lets you use a common switch, but make it act like it's several switches in several different networks. And those networks yes. can be made to not see each other at all, or in where they need to, they can be made to see each other with the right permissions and the right holes and stuff.
Yeah, so you have controlled access between the LANs or between the islands, toll bridges. And yes, it's a managed switch. So don't expect to do it with a switch that's not managed. You'll know what I mean. If you know what I mean by managed switch, then you're okay. If you don't, look it up.
Awesome. Good deal. Doug Watson has been our guest. Doug, it's been a pleasure to have you on. You can now be found at a company called Link Up Communications. Mark Johnson is your partner there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Mark Johnson is my boss. Great guy. Mark and Karen both great people to work for. Yeah,
they were on a conversation with Barry Mishkin just this afternoon, and I heard I heard Mark give some advice about these C-band filters. The short story that I heard is you don't need to buy one; they'll be provided. Does that sound right?
As long as you've registered your C-band downlink, they will be provided.
And we're going to do a show on this topic down the road, probably get Mark on and you'd be welcome too. But, if you registered your C-band dish, you know about the space grab that's going on. You're going to lose, the satellite providers are losing some of their bandwidth, and there may be interference to what's left. And so if you registered your C-band dish, you are going to be provided with a filter to keep, Google or whoever out of your proper reception of your networks. Did I say that about right?
Yeah, it's close enough.
Close enough. All right.
Well, with a filter installation, I mean, it's basically you shouldn't have to do anything.
Gotcha. So don't buy one. Don't fall for.
Yes.
Nothing. People may be selling them. You don't have to buy one. You'll be provided with one. All right. Good deal.
Right.
Doug Watson, thanks again. Good to see you. And we'll catch up with you on a later show. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us in New York City. How high above the ground are you? Are you like way above the sidewalk?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm about 17 stories up.
So
about
what?
70 feet. Yeah, up on a balcony, looking down onto the avenues. Well, actually, there's nobody on the streets, but yeah, I'm just looking down at empty streets. It's good. And you can hear the ice cream truck outside. I'm not sure who's serving them.
Wow. Hey, coming up, Chris, on the next couple of shows, I'm hoping to get a fellow with a wireless ISP on next week's show. But if we don't, maybe you and I will talk. And then 2 weeks from today, we're going to be visiting a radio museum where they have lots of old radios. It's actually at a radio station, about an hour drive from me here. So we're going to be visiting, Beth Mann at some radio stations, just barely into Kentucky from here. So we're going to do a live broadcast from there, walk around, talk to her engineer and talk to, she's the curator. So we'll, talk to her about these old radios. It's going to be a fun look back in the, history of radios, actual physical reception radios. So that'll be good.
I look forward to that. Definitely look forward.
Yeah,
to that.
Me too. I am. All right, we got to go. Thanks a lot to Suncast, our producer, and also thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Thanks again to Doug Watson and to Chris Tobin. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.